Statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Tone and Tenor, a show that explores current issues of the day and listens to bipartisan voices of the people. We want to hear from you with your phone calls and on social media. Now, here are the hosts of Tone and Tenor.
Welcome to the Tone and Tenor show, Bipartisan Voices of the People. I'm Randall Jefferson.
And I'm Cherie Horsey Darton, the owner and publisher of Scoop USA Media.
Our show looks at major issues impacting the nation and region from a bipartisan perspective. We want to hear from you, our listeners. Call, ask questions. Our call-in number is 1-888-329-3306. That's 1-888-329-3306. Our phone lines are now open. You can also send us your comments via social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToneAndTenor. You can also like us on our Facebook page. Just type in the words Tone and Tenor in the Facebook search engine to find us. Our show's topic today is year 2020, locally, regionally, and nationally. Cherie, Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to our listeners. And Happy New Year to everyone across the country and to those that support us here at WWDB. Happy New Year, Brett.
You know, so since you had a long sentence, I'll say Happy New Year back.
You know, as this is a short week and this is the first week of the new year, I thought that the best thing is to try to begin to put year 2020 in perspective, if we can really do that. Mm-hmm. Locally, there's a lot going on here in Philadelphia and in the state. Regionally, there's a lot going on, and most definitely nationally, you know, even up until last night with the bombing in Iraq.
Yes.
So there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to that we can look at and then formulate the shows for the upcoming weeks and months, and looking ahead to the RNC and the DNC conventions for the summer on who will be the both parties' nominees for president.
So before we get started, can we kind of not so much focus on the presidential election? Because we both know the presidential election is, of course, what the entire world is talking about, mm-hmm. but it is not the most important part of the 2020 election. So if we can kind of just like not deal with that at all today, and we can focus on the things that people need to know, because I think everybody knows that there's a presidential election coming up this year. But nobody seems to know that the state representatives are going to be up for election mm-hmm. this year.
State
nobody
Senate.
Seems to know that the other people in these positions, if we don't pay attention to what it is that they do, no matter who's in the office of president, we will be in a very, very, very difficult situation.
And I agree with you.
So I mean, because everybody, all you hear is president, everybody's, president,
president.
And there's a reason for that.
And you're absolutely right, because most folks are not talking about what's going on locally and in the regions that have a major impact on individuals, on businesses. And you're absolutely right, you know. Because if in reality, let's really think about it. If the presidency is all well and good, you know, that's the executive branch. But again, if we're going to focus on, we need to focus on the region. We need to focus on those local congressmen. We need to focus on those folks that are going, those 435 individuals in the House of Representatives and those 100 cardinals in the Senate that are actually making the decisions. And then we trickle back down to the states and to their houses and to their representatives. And then we come in just in Philadelphia. We are going to have a new sitting council, several new members in council.
Monday.
You know, on Monday will take their seats. And, you know, people have to begin to look at what's going on first locally and regionally, and then as we move even forward into the month of February, we will again have a special election for the 190th, and we will meet again who will take her seat. Danielle Outlaw is a new Philadelphia police commissioner. Mm-hmm. You know, so and you know, we're in the first few days of the month here in Philadelphia, and we've already had murders. We've already had, and it's not just Philadelphia.
It's across the globe.
It's across the country. So where do we begin? Let's begin with what you brought up. You brought up the region. Mm-hmm. And you brought up state representatives.
Well, and those are Pennsylvania state. I'm not even talking about the federal level.
We're talking about state Pennsylvania state representatives and Senate. And for the 190th district, state rep district, we have a special election that's mm-hmm. going to take place on February 25th. February 25th, there will be a special election. The general election will be in April. Mm-hmm. So
here we go
again. Here we go again, you know, the same scenario. Unfortunately, we're... people are faced with in the 190th, which the seat was held by, again, was done through special election when Vanessa Brown was mm-hmm. had to give up the office due to problems. And then Mavita Harold Johnson was elected after being picked by the Democratic Committee to represent them. And promises were made that everything was taken care of or what have you. And then, as usual in Philadelphia, if you don't play in the right sandbox, they come back at you. You know, and then, you know, I believe that, this is just me speaking, people, that when you're making impacts across the aisle and you're not getting permission from powers that be, then you have a problem. So former state rep Mavita has resigned from office. That set up this special election with in February for the 190th, with again the ward leaders of the district and committee people of the district making the decision on who they would back for the 190th for the state representative, which is interesting. The woman that was backed, her name, she is G. Ronnie Green. Her full name is Gwendolyn.
Okay.
Ronnie Green. She goes by G. Ronnie Green. She is a member of the SEIU, okay. Local 668. She was a business manager, or is the business manager. Okay. In 2014, she ran for the presidency of the SEIU and lost. She won. She's the committee person of 38th Ward.
Okay.
So she won those wards, the 4th, the 6th, the 24th, 38th, and 52nd, all backed her for the 190th. But what really bothers me, Cherie, I live in the 190th.
Okay.
It's amazing how folks are picked for these positions and you don't know who they are.
Answer this. Do you know anybody who's actually doing positive work in your neighborhood that you could identify?
Oh, yeah, I could.
That would be perfect for these roles?
I could identify them, but the problem would be, again, you know, when you look at them, they must succumb to the powers that be, which are ward leaders and the Democratic Committee, which is run by the chair is... former Congressman Bob Brady, and the vice chair is Councilwoman
Janie Blackwell.
Janie Blackwell, who will give up her seat come Monday to of the 4th District to Jaime Gutierrez, who won the election in November to unseat the incumbent. But
so back to the 190th.
Most folks, when you look at the people, some of the folks that were named, you have they that were named to run, former working families, Mr. O'Rourke, that ran for council, Jabari, who I believe 60th Street Business.
He's
one of them. What was interesting, the Inquirer names Michael Horsey, but he did not show up. He sent a representative, his daughter, to speak in his stay on that day. So it's really interesting because most of the folks that normally are in the 190th are on the north side of Market Street in Philadelphia. They do not come, those that have been elected are not from the south side of Market Street.
They're from my side.
North side, from your side.
Okay.
North side. When you think about it, you had Tommy Blackwell, you had Vanessa Brown, Movita's office was on Movita, and Movita Harold, her foundation is on the north side, and her businesses were on the north side. And you really have to think about who came from the south side of Market Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. You know, you don't see those folks, even those that are in office. Once they get in office, you do not see them south side of Market Street, unless they're at the University of Pennsylvania or at Drexel, you know, and helping to, they're in that area. You know, then the, what's interesting, the 190th goes across to North Philadelphia, around 35th and Allegheny, that area.
Up in it, yes.
And all of that area where the 190th is being gentrified.
Very much so.
So what is happening when you got the 190 being gentrified from 34, well, from Penn up, and, you know, where the universities are, but you don't see these representatives too often once they take office. You know, when you really think about it, you had, at one time, they tried to unseat Vanessa Brown by bringing in now Senator Sharif Street, by saying he moved into the 190th. He at that time he was backed by Councilwoman Blackwell, but the people in the 190th wouldn't fall for that okie doke. Tommy Blackwell, who's now deceased, was Lucian Blackwell's son.
That was his
and
seat.
Unfortunately, Tommy lost his seat because he had folks out there with his petitions, and the petitions, they found majority of them being invalid, so he could not make it to the ballot.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, when you start looking at these scenarios of what's going on in the 190th, what's going on in the 190th that just did not happen. You know, this didn't happen with Vanessa Brown. This didn't happen with Movita. This just didn't happen. It has been a chess game in the 190th, almost a forgotten district.
I don't think so. I think there's just too much going on in that district for it to be forgotten. I think that it's just not being talked about because the people in that district still don't know the many things that are happening. And that's our problem.
And you're absolutely right.
Because they don't know anything about what's going on. They are drawn in the university district where you have Drexel and Penn and all of that stuff going on. So when houses and buildings go up, the assumption is that it's theirs and that they have money and we can't compete with them, yada, yada, yada. That's what the thoughts are. And because those are the thoughts, people live in their homes, pay their taxes, and hope that nobody knocks on their door saying that we have to move because we're doing this, that, and the third. It ends up being a situation where people feel as though they don't really have any type of argument or control over the things that are going on in their neighborhood. And gentrification is in that neighborhood, period. It has been. It has been since the late 80s. When I had my apartment, I lived in that neighborhood with my first apartment. And the houses on, I lived on 46 and Osage up in that area. And mm-hmm. and the houses were going for $250 now. I think they're way over $1 million now.
I think that's the 186.
Yeah, I'm just saying that the neighborhood, right. the mm-hmm. Penn Drexel area, period, which all kind of overlaps.
Right.
You know, the 190th and the numbers are, but they're all in that same mix. With the property and the schools and the people who actually have tons of money to invest and to build and to move people out. And that's been going on from that sector since the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And now it's come to a point now where you have diverse, very diverse neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the average person who lives in that neighborhood, black and browns, minorities, are barely making it. Even those who have had good jobs and retired. I talked to a retiree the other day who was speaking about, and I was in another state, and she was speaking about her property and managing it and how she paid her mortgage off, and now it seems like the taxes and all of that on her property is higher than what it was when she was paying the mortgage. And it's because she's now on what one would consider a decent fixed income. She's a former teacher. Her husband was, mm-hmm. they had businesses. But she says day-to-day living is still tight for somebody who actually retired with a good income coming in still.
Right. And you think about it, the 190th, when we really think about the 190th, and I compare, the 190th encompasses what we call 52nd Street in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at 52nd Street today, and what 52nd Street was years ago, mm-hmm. you can compare that to those, to Passyunk Avenue in South Philly, where you did not have to leave the neighborhood to make purchases. Now we have everything under the sun on 52nd Street that, and this is not a knock to the businesses on 52nd Street, but we have, I remember when Mayor Nutter came down, and then we had the 52nd Street Business Association, and they put up these awnings and all of this, and this was supposed to make 52nd Street, the corridor of West Philly, more viable, more unique.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen. You still have the carts. You still have McDonald's that gets closed down almost every other month due to health issues, by the health department. You have things that it's like a forgotten corridor. And it's time that, you know, when I think about 52nd Street, and I had this conversation with a friend of mine just recently, we could talk about the post office being there.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about Western Union. We could talk about PSFS. We could talk about PNC. We could talk about Florsheim Shoes. We could talk about Shapiro Shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Deck House for your school supplies, which was there. Woolworths
was on the corner.
Sunrays and the Fountain was in at 52nd and Walnut. You know, you had Mr. Silks for the older folks that went. They got dressed up to go to 52nd mm-hmm. Street. Now you go down 52nd Street, and what is there? You know, yes, Citizens Bank has taken over the old Checkers building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the PSFS building is now empty. Provident is gone. You know, so how do we, until we start generating money in our community with real sustainable businesses, and not just those folks that are standing that have stores, and hopefully, you know, whoever takes the 190th and whoever's the council person will look into this, because what has happened is that if you have a business privilege license and you own one of those stores right there, you can take that cart, move it outside, pay somebody outside $25, $30 a day to sell from your cart, which is all cash. You can't even walk down 52nd Street. But because of the loophole, and no knock to Mr. Street, and I'm talking about Milton, who got it when he threw, when he was was the rep about vendors. No knock to vendors that are trying to make a living. But we need to begin to have our hold our representatives, our council people, and ourselves. Because, that you know, we want to blame everybody else, but we have to hold ourselves also accountable, too, on what's going on. You know, I remember just around the corner from me was a florist on the corner of 52nd and Spruce. You go to 52nd and Spruce now, crackheads, drug addicts, and everything else. You know, they even tried to, during the drugs times with, what's his name? I forgot his name. They tried to close the place down. But what has happened, again, they open the store midday and keep it open all night long, you know? And the law says that you're supposed to be selling, if you're selling liquor, you're supposed to be selling X amount of food.
And they don't.
And they don't. You could go right around, again, the 190th, you can go on Lancaster Avenue, and you can go into those small stores, and you could buy liquor by the shot, right through the glass. So, you know, we need to begin to, as folks, and I know I hear your voice in my head now, you know, we don't have, you know, we're just trying, people are trying to make it by day to day
because, to satisfy themselves. Because
they don't have the time.
You ask me questions all of the time, don't you know this? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't. You know, and I'm, as I say all of the time, I'm somebody who's supposed to know certain things. But we get so consumed with living day to day. We are dealing with death. We are dealing with kidnappings. We are dealing with
murders,
this, that, and the third. You don't want to come out of your house after a certain time at night because you don't know what's going to happen. You're sitting there not wondering about what is going to go on. How is this happening? If your kids are not home, you can't sleep. It's not the type of situation where you really, really want to be concerned about whether or not the man on the corner is sliding somebody a shot of liquor when your kid just got killed. It's serious. Like, the severity and the differences of the conversations are there. Like, people really don't care about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about it at all. They want people in these positions who are going to be able to think outside of the box, who are not going to try to put a circle in a square, who are going to think and do something different than what was done in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, because we are different people. We are dealing with different 2020, not 19, 2020. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with different situations,
right.
Different people. Everything is different. It's not the same. It's not. And that's what the problem is. I give credit to all of these people who are in office who are doing the best that they can. Because I understand. I think all of the time.
And I agree. Those that are doing the best that they can.
But
I agree with you. Those that are just there taking up space and looking for a paycheck.
What are they getting a paycheck, whether they do anything or not, because they got the position. So, seriously, once you got the job, trust me, you can move papers from one side of the table to the other and look busy.
You're absolutely right.
So that's the reality. You don't actually physically have to kill yourself. But when you have situations where people are dying every single day, you have kids who have been caught up in crossfires who have now been gone and taken away from their families, babies who haven't done anything to anybody.
If you know, just to touch on something you just said, if my memory is correct, in 2019, though we talked about the maximum number of deaths, largest number since 2007 in Philadelphia was 355, 356. But No one's, just like you said, babies, 108 youngsters were caught up in some type of gunfire. 108 youngsters. You know, these are the things that we should, like you said, are important. Because you have young children. You have grandchildren.
I have a 13-year-old who does not leave my house.
Right. So it's not like...
I have a 13-year-old who does not have half of the inkling of the knowledge about life I had when I was 13. Because she is relegated to my house. Well, look, she is not allowed to go outside.
You are a little older than 13. And what do I always say to you?
About me going outside?
About when you're leaving, where you're at and all of that. To be careful. Because it's not even safe out there for anyone. And nobody wants to. We need to address that.
But I'm not
community.
Even talking about as an adult, because I've had my chances to be outside in the streets. Most of us have been able to play in the front of your door, to have a sandbox, to play in the dirt, to ride your bike in front
to
of the
sit
street.
On your porch.
I bought my daughter a bike last Christmas. Not 19, 18. It still has the tags on it. Literally. Still has the tags on it. You know why? Because she's not going outside without me. And where am I? I'm doing scoop the streets, this, that, and the third. She's not going outside. Her dad is in the house. He's not going outside. So what does that mean? She's never rid her bike. She probably doesn't know any of the kids from the next block over. When you were younger, didn't you know everybody in your neighborhood? I mean, this is a reality. This is the life that we live. And I see myself as a parent who has a married family. I have a family. I have a good home. I live one block over from the 190th. Mm-hmm. So keeping it 150% real, what is it that the things that people are concerned about? I don't care about the man giving out the wine and the liquor. I probably need to go get a shot myself. Because I live in a neighborhood where my daughter can't go sit on a daggone porch.
That's true.
I mean...
You live in a neighborhood where someone was abducted not too far from where you live.
I know. Like an hour before I got home.
So,
I got that call. Like, you need to not be coming in the house in the middle of the night.
These are the realities that should be...
Focused
on. And our elected officials that we should really be hammering home to. And with that... The realities of what we should focus on, when you were talking about thinking out of the box, we're going to come back to and discuss how Mayor Kenney went out of the box for the new hire police commissioner for Philadelphia, who will start in February. We're going to take a quick break now. You're listening to Tone and Tenor here on WWDB Talk 860 AM.
The Tone and Tenor Show is sponsored by Factotum Business and Government Solutions, a unique lobby consulting company that services business and governmental clients through long-standing bipartisan relationships. It is Factotum's mission to provide business solutions for both profit and nonprofit organizations, connecting them to officials in local, state, and federal governments. Factotum has offices in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. For more information on Factotum Business and Government Solutions, call 866-795-4484. That's 866-795-4484.
Welcome back to Tone and Tenor here on WWDB Talk 860 AM. I'm Randall Jefferson with my co-host, Miss Sherry Horsey Darden, owner and publisher of Scoop USA Media. Our topic today is year 2020, locally, regionally, and nationally. When we went to break, Sherry had mentioned about thinking out of the box. Well, in February, Philadelphia will have its first female
African-American
female and the youngest, it's believed to be the youngest police commissioner, Ms. Danielle Outlaw, will take the reins of the department that has been in somewhat of a turmoil, and she has to come in here and think out of the box to, as she said in her address, that it's not going, it's going to, she can do, and the police can do what they can do, but it's going to take all of us, all of us, to solve some of these problems so that Cherie's daughter can go out and ride her bike, so that folks can go and walk down the street and play in the street and feel safe. She has a Herculean job on her shoulders. You know, maybe she may want to go back to Wheel of Fortune and win $40,000 again. That was much easier when she won when she was a student. She won
Wheel of Fortune
$40,000. So, but she's coming in. She's coming in from originally from Oakland, California.
My hometown.
And then deputy commissioner, or, I'm sorry, commissioner of Portland. And then she's going to take the reins here in Philadelphia of a department that has seen, not just recently, but over the years, its course of dysfunctionality. She has a Herculean job. She's got to work with a union. She's got to work with community organizations, you know, and lead a 6,000-plus man and woman's department. And you have to think about this. Mayor Kenney, as everyone, as some organizations protested, they wanted transparency, they wanted this, they in the process and all. Mayor Kenney stuck by his guns, and he said that by the end of the year, he would name a police commissioner. And which is interesting, there were 30 candidates on his list, both internal and external. And Danielle Outlaw rose to the top. And I believe, after reading and hearing about her, believe that because, one, of her age, and two, of her ability to think out of the box, you know, and listening to her as being no nonsense, I think, I'm not speaking for the mayor, but I think this is what made her rise to the top. I don't think it was based on, you know, everybody was yelling color. I think it was based on what she brings and her credentials.
All right, so from the HR perspective, all of the things that you has identified as things that people would look at are not even allowed to be considered.
But in any of these processes. The argument that you have these organizations,
people can say whatever it is that they want to say, but when you're dealing with certain situations such as this, which is a very, very important position, you have to stick to the requirements and the laws behind hiring people. And her age, number one, had nothing to do with this. Her sex, her ethnicity had nothing to do with this. This was all based on that wonderful resume that she has. That wonderful resume, that wonderful outline of the things that she has achieved in her lifetime as a police officer, and the dedication that she has given. And she has not just been in an administrative position, meaning she's been in charge of something. She was an assistant for years, and then she became a chief or a commissioner. So she's led, she has supervised, she has developed those specific skills that unfortunately a lot of people may not directly have. Because with that comes the ability to do the administrative functions, as well as if you have to take off and put on some boots and hit the street and do regular work. Because people like to see that you have grown within and that you can do the job that you're actually asking people to do. Because that's very important. Not that you can do it, but you're also willing to. To come down and step into somebody else's shoes.
So Sharif.
And, you know, and I haven't had a chance to meet her. I'm just...
You're talking logistics and facts. From an HR perspective, and I welcome that, because you know we get so tied up on color and ethnicity, and you know even CBS right here says Outlaw began her career in NBC. Outlaw began her career in her hometown, Oakland, California, where she served for nearly 20 years in the Oakland Police Department and rose through the ranks to become Deputy Chief of Police. Mm-hmm. During her tenure in Oakland, she was awarded the 2015 Gary Hayes Award, a national honor that recognizes leadership in law enforcement. That goes to what you said about her resume. Mm-hmm. Then we go back, and this goes back to what you were saying. This is not Outlaw's first time making history. In October 2017, she became the first African-American woman to be appointed chief of police in Portland, Oregon. Well, you know, again, we understand the importance and of from a the minority standpoint and all mm-hmm. of that. But as you stated, and I think that, and you said it so human resourcefully, that it's not about the color of her skin
not
or
at all.
Her gender.
Not at all.
You know, what organizations wanted, it was about the best man or woman that would take this department and begin to heal it. That has had problems throughout the course of the years. You know, she's not the first out of not from the, out of the ranks. Mm-hmm. Charles Ramsey before Commissioner Ross came from D.C. Very well respected, very, but he came to Philadelphia. And I think that he found out that Philadelphia is a very interesting place.
It's very interesting.
To deal with. And one thing that I'm hoping that the unions and the organizations will give the, give her and the department a chance to heal.
Well, just logistically speaking again. Within any type of transition, the expectation is that nothing is going to happen overnight, and you want to give somebody a chance to first come in, assess the department, meet with people, become familiar with Philadelphia, with mm-hmm. the things that are here, the things that can be done, and then the expectation comes. So you're not going to think that in 6 months she's going to walk in and everything's going to be hunky-dory and nothing's going to be the same. Or
but,
that one
but,
week,
but no.
And then you saw the day after she was interviewed, yep. people were trying to say that it was her fault that something was happening. She's not even here.
She's not here.
So
but those
so,
are those are the internet no, reporters.
Those are not
that
just
are,
internet
run,
reporters.
Run out there. And
those are people in general who, number one, who go to the extent that they feel as though, which makes being a black woman sometimes extremely hard. Especially
you can say
for those
a little louder. It's
being
you
a black
whisper.
Woman extremely hard because you have all of the naysayers and all of the negativity that comes against who we are from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
because we are strong people. We don't just conform and go with whatever people want to say. We live with our gut, our feelings, and our knowledge. Because whether or not people want to know, we actually really, really are highly intelligent, most of us. And when you, yeah, you're shaking your head. But when you're in those positions and you're already expected to not be able to get those jobs compared to other people, and what people don't know is as black women, our ability to compete or our desire, we work four times harder than everybody else who always interviews for these jobs. You know why? Because we already know the expectation. We already know that we have to go come hard or go home. Because you're not going to win if you're not three times better than everybody else. You're not. So her getting this says already that she is a hard worker. She knows what she's dealing with. She's going to work extra hard to go above and beyond. That you may not get from anybody else, particularly people who are in positions where they feel they're entitled and this is something that they deserve, yada, yada, yada. Because when you work hard for it, you're not going to fail. You're not going to fail. So coming into this, I can actually see somebody coming into this who's not from this area. She has to learn the area. She has to learn the people. She has to learn the office. She has to learn the protocols, policies, this, that, and the third. Some things may be the same as they are everywhere else. Some things may be very different.
Well, as she said, one of the things she said, you weren't here in her speech, she said that it's still, whether you're Oakland or Portland, Philadelphia is still, all three are urban cities. It's just more people, and you just have to get the logistics. And I'm paraphrasing. The logistics and the lay of the land, and you can almost work accordingly within the same type of framework.
You can map out the same type of plan, but it's just really, for a bigger crowd,
right? You know, and I think that's going to be what I think the expectations folks are going to try to put.
The only thing I ask is that people give her an opportunity to be patient,
and I think that's what needs to. Again, I want you to say that again and say it with conviction and authority, because this is what we here in Philadelphia don't do. Once we get somebody new in office, we don't.
She needs to be given an opportunity to learn the lay of the land and to do her job effectively. That does not mean after 30 days you should expect Philadelphia to be something other than what it is. It's not going to happen that quickly. It is not going to happen without the support of the community. The problem that's here now is not so much the people in places. It's the community is not actually stepping up. Question, has anybody paid attention to what happened over the bridge in Camden? Are you paying attention to the news? The things that are going on over there? I'm fortunate enough to be over there because my paper's over there. But have you seen the difference in Camden? What happens when people decide that they don't want to live the type of life that they're living no more, and they step out and they come together? When things go wrong, I saw it over there. They were closing the school. Those people came together so quick and said, you're not closing this school, that the state had to go back and look at it and decide that they were going to shuffle money and make sure that school stayed open.
And she's talking about Camden, New Jersey, for those folks that
are not
in the Philadelphia area.
And you you just know. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is... You can walk over the bridge.
And those folks, I agree with you, they came together. They didn't jump up and down. They came together with a plan saying, this is not going to happen. This is why it's not going to happen. And this is what we want.
But they do so many things. They come together. They help feed each other. They have a situation. I think I saw one of the former owner and publisher of Scoop, Mr. Sonny Driver, his nephew Amir, is a pastor over there. And I'm friends with him on Facebook. I follow him, and it helps me keep up with the things that I need to know for Camden. They have portable showers put outside so the homeless people can take showers. Like, they're trying to do things to change life, period, for everyone who is there.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting that you went into that segue, because earlier today, I was listening to another show that airs on this station, and they talked about gentrification and the relationship of gentrification and infrastructure and homelessness.
Wow, that's an interesting conversation.
But what was interesting about it, they never said how all three were related, or how all three
impacted each other.
They just talked about infrastructure will solve gentrification. Well, how can infrastructure solve gentrification? How can infrastructure solve homelessness? You know, that goes to what you were saying. You know, we live in a city that's number one in poverty, number one in hunger, and whatever given day, if you go into Center City on Vine Street, you see a tent city. Or if you come off of Walt Whitman Bridge, I'm sorry, Ben Franklin Bridge, you have the tent city. Coming from Camden, where you just talked about, you have the homelessness. You know, why can't, and I've been thinking about this. We have all of these churches that are closing. We have all of these mega buildings that are closing. Why can't we do like they did in some of our southern cities? Take those buildings, transform those into safe havens and shelters for homeless people, and then give them the opportunity to feel as though they are safe. Because most are saying they don't want to go to the shelters because what little personal belongings they have gets stolen. But if you go down south, particularly Jacksonville, when you come in off of 95, they built a beautiful building with the showers, with doctors, with people, so that to help those in need. You know, and
I'm all for helping people who are in need, but I want to be able to help them not continue to be in need.
Right.
Because I've learned, unfortunately, the hard way by trying to get people to work for me. And I've called a couple of homeless shelters and I'm like, can you get somebody? They need jobs. I need people to work. Nobody shows up. There's this pride thing in Philadelphia where people don't believe that they have to do anything. They don't want to do anything. You can try to give somebody a job without even asking really qualifications, and they don't want it. They think that certain things are beneath them, and I don't know where that comes from. And that's a huge problem with the poverty, and why things are the way that they are here is because people feel as though this is beneath them. I can't even begin to figure that out.
Well, I think that part of the problem is, and I agree with you, that we have these, I mean, particularly, I'll say I don't have a problem with it. We have what they call Hub of Hope.
Okay.
Which is at 15th and Market, mm-hmm. under the L.
Okay. And they help people.
And allegedly help people. Mm-hmm. You know, but when you push sticking people 8, 9, 10 feet underground in the dark, how are you helping people? You know, Hub of Hope. How do you bring hope to somebody? Or how do you, there are some folks that just like you just said, that could benefit by selling your paper or doing something, mm-hmm. that, and most folks, if you go around the Franklin Institute, a lot of the homeless people that are around there are vets, mm-hmm. and some of them are highly educated folks, but for whatever reason, they went down on their luck. And until we identify real solutions that don't just give them the helping hand, but give them the hand up so that they can get to where they need to be. You know, one thing that people forget, and, you know, public assistance, welfare, or whatever you want to call it, that was instituted by the federal government has become a generational crutch.
To an extent.
Because it was supposed to be in place to help those that fell on their luck, to help them get back to where they need to be. Mm-hmm. But when you, having worked in that type of system, when you just give people pieces of paper, tell them to go here, go there, you know, that's not really trying to deal with what the real solution problem to the solution is.
I'm going to defer to that because I'm a product of the welfare system. I grew up. I got a GPA check.
That's right.
And we got food stamps. And when I turned 18, I was never in the system as an adult because I was raised and taught that was something that was for then. And that's when right. I was able to do, I needed to do, which
and
is
that
why
is what
I ended
was
up
supposed
with
to,
three
that
jobs.
Was put in.
But it's only a crutch to those who use it as a crutch, mm-hmm. and it's only a crutch to those who are allowed to use it as a crutch. Because at 18, I became pregnant and I thought I was going to get welfare and have an easy life for a couple of years. They told me I was able and willing to get a job. Go get one. Denied. Red stamp. So it only becomes a crutch to those who are in a position and who are allowed to let it be a crutch. And since the Obamas changed the law and made welfare something where it is a 2-year term that you can get it and then you have to get off. Things are changed. They are not what they were in the 80s and the 90s. People can't live off of welfare and be on it forever. They have all these other programs that people can manipulate and move money and try to make that work. But for the most part, most people are expected to have some type of job now. You know, and that's where the condition and the question is constantly coming up about the minimum wage and the need for people to make more than $7.25, because that is something that you cannot live off of.
I know that's right.
People can't live off of $15, technically.
No,
spend $100 at the supermarket on soda. You're laughing, but you know it's
true. You're right.
I went to the supermarket Saturday. I bought 3 things of fruit, some soda, and some coffee, and it was $85.
What kind of coffee did you buy?
I bought the case of the little things that
The
Keurig things. But I bought the Acme brand, and it was $20, so I didn't even buy the expensive ones. This is crazy. But at that rate, $15 is not enough, because I didn't buy one piece of meat. So there you go with poverty. Seriously, how is it that the expectation is for somebody to live off of $7? $7 times 80 hours in a 2-week period, what's that, $560?
Well, Sheree, there's some important dates that we're going to move it to the region real quick.
The 190th, because I think we need to do that and figure out who's running go a little more.
The 190th... right now, we don't even really know who's running.
But when are the timelines for that?
I'm going to give the timeline. Well, the 25th is the
election.
The petition date, I don't see that. But for the general,
because they have to get signatures and stuff, go through the entire same process as everyone else.
The nominee doesn't, but anyone else has to.
Okay.
You know, if there's going to be some quote-unquote nine, they can be Democrats, but not
Republicans.
You know, well, they can be it could be someone else. Challenger could be a Republican, too.
Okay.
You know, I don't have that timeline, but you asked earlier, when do they begin circulating for the state elections? The first day to circulate and file petitions will be January 28th.
So that's in 3 weeks.
Yep. The last day to circulate petitions will be February 18th.
And almost all of the representatives, is everyone almost up again?
That should be, yes.
Okay.
Then you have the 19th is the first day to circulate and file nomination papers. The last day to withdraw by the candidate is March 4th. The last day for you as a voter to register for that election is April 13th. April 21st is the last day to apply for mail-in or civilian absentee ballot.
Okay.
And then the last day county board to receive voted mail-in ballots and all of that good stuff will be by 8 p.m. April 28th. And the general election is April 28th. What one has to remember.
So the general election is
April 28th.
Oh, wow.
So what one has to remember, even though there is a special election, February 25th for the 190th, if the candidate, whoever wins, chooses to run.
They have to run
for the April 28th election.
Are you kidding me?
No, they have to run.
So we could have just waited and done all of this for April.
Well, that was the argument that, you know, to save the money. But because the state constitution calls
for someone in that seat for a certain amount of times. Okay.
So that's had to take place. So that's going to be.
So they're going to be the rep for 2 months. They probably won't even
be
sworn
the rep
in.
They're going to finish out the term.
Mm-hmm.
Which
they'll
will
get
take
through
them,
January.
Right.
Okay.
And then they would, if they won in 2021, then they would be, if they want the full term.
Okay. So if someone does not win, at the special election, then they can actually run again.
Right, they could run again in general. Mm-hmm. So if, say, Sheree Darden Horsey runs in special election and...
Don't put that out
and
there.
And she wins. She has the ability to now turn around in March and April.
I need to.
In March
and April. If I want to hold my seat.
Right.
I need to.
Right.
I would have to... While I'm running, technically, while I'm doing my special election, I would have to be getting petitions for the actual. So you'd have to be doing double duty.
That's absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you would have to, as you said, do double duty.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, and the candidate for the 190th, the Democratic nominee, party nominee for the special election, Gwendolyn Green, mm-hmm. you know, G. Ronnie Green, committee woman from the 38th, has already said that if she was to win, she was running for the full term.
So answer this question again. So you actually do have enough time that if you win, then you can decide, or do you need to actually be getting those petitions together at the same time?
You have to follow that same
guidelines
the deadline for the petitions
is what date?
Deadlines for those petitions were, I took that off real quick. 1 second. I will get those to you. But,
okay.
But it would have to be... They start in January. They start January 28th.
Yeah, the end of January.
So basically what you're doing, if you're going to run.
But you have to have your comfort level, you know?
That's right. Hey, I think we're getting put out.
We are getting put out. And I think that with 2020, I believe that this is a year for faith, hope, and love. And I've spread that all over my paper, and it is in my heart. And I think that we're off to a interesting start. And this year, as I said, the elections are going to be a whole lot more to us than what we actually are paying attention to right now. So,
and we want to thank our engineer today. Thank you, Mr. Brett, for your listener, Tone and Tenor, here on WWDB Talk 860 AM. I'm Randall Jefferson.
And I'm Sheree Horsey Dart. And please reach out and get your copy of Scoop.
Thank you for listening to Tone and Tenor here on WWDB Talk 860 AM.